I think, like you say, like I said before, he's learning. I know his heart's in the right place.
How do you know that?
I've had some candid conversations with him about this, especially during that time. I've had some very candid conversations, so I do really believe his heart's in the right place.
What does that mean? His heart is in the right place. I've talked to him. He's learning. His heart's in the right place. Do you remember the argument being made against one President Obama that he just did not have enough experience to be in this job? But don't worry, this guy's learning. His heart's in the right place. What does that mean? That means, yeah, he's a misogynist. Yeah, he's accused of being a rapist. Yeah, he endorsed a child molester. Okay, yeah, he's super gross. Yeah, he speaks at a fourth grade level. But he believes in the same economic ideas as us. And we, the United States GOP, that runs both houses of Congress, as well as the executive branch, and the Supreme Court, we are sociopaths. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 236. Clearly, I've got it in for these mother lovers today.
We're back. There's a new Washington Post story that broke since we've been on the air. We had to sneak in that break to make it family friendly. Let me read you a little bit from that piece. The title, Trump Attacks Protections for Immigrants from Bleep Hole Countries in Oval Office Meetings. I hope I did that okay. President Trump grew frustrated, from the piece by Josh Dossie writing in the Washington Post. Quote, President Trump grew frustrated with lawmakers Thursday in the Oval Office when they floated restoring protections for immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and African countries as part of a bipartisan immigration deal, according to two people briefed on the meeting. Quote, why are we having all these people from bleep countries come here?
So that was the way it started. I was listening to MSNBC on the radio. And, you know, I jump back and forth between Fox and MSNBC and CNN. And then, of course, the right-wing shows, Michael Berry, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity. And I just happen to be listening to MSNBC. And then all of a sudden I hear, we'll be right back. And they just cut out in the middle of a segment. What in the bloody hell is that? And then they come back and they go, we're sorry, we just had to take a minute to try to make this statement family friendly. Family friendly? What the hell? And then they said, you know, of course, everyone's heard the, you know, what Trump said about the bleep hole countries. And she goes, is that okay? I said bleep hole. Is that okay? So it's weird that that part even happened. First of all, it's weird that it's happening because of the president. And the other part of that that's weird is about an hour or so later, they just let that word fly. They were saying the S word. It was crazy. And I heard dozens of callers get kicked off of terrestrial radio when they called in to radio talk shows and tried to say that word, tried to repeat the presidential language. So, a couple things. Obviously, they get to say that on cable news. They usually opt to not say that, which I really appreciate. Here on this show, I don't use that language. Now, I'm not so prissy that I do not use it in my everyday life, because I do. I listen to gross music. I watch gross movies. I'm completely fine with this kind of language. But what I'm not okay with is, one, the media using it, which is why I, as a, you know, as a guy who does media, I just prefer not to use it in this medium. I don't think it helps. I understand there's an old saying that to be profound, sometimes you have to be profane. And I think that there's a better way to get the point across. But cable news, they were just letting the S-hole fly. And it was crazy. Then after they got over the fact that they were saying that word, they finally got to the meat of the subject.
It confirms what I've said on this show before. Donald Trump is a bigot. But it also exposes something about the immigration debate in this country. There's always this underlying kind of claim, or the worry, that what's driving immigration in this country, or the worry about immigration, is not that the system is broken, but that the country is browning. That folks are concerned about all of these people of color in the country, and they're trying to figure out, how do we stem the tide of the demographic shift in the country? That immigration is really just another way of talking about race.
All of a sudden, Haitians. If you were a Haitian anything, you're a Haitian store owner, you're a Haitian writer, you're a Haitian actor, everybody Haitian, because Trump specifically spoke out against Haitians. If you were Haitian, there was a pretty solid chance that you're going to get on the news, because they needed to speak to a Haitian.
Haiti is a place where there are so many people that are educated that come over to the United States, who are professors, who are doctors, like my mother, who's a social worker. My father still lives in Haiti. He runs a large nonprofit there. So this really feels, I think, goes to the core of what Haitian Americans have given to America, which is really a lot of time, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And like I said, there's a monument, literally a monument in Savannah, Georgia, dedicated to Haitians, free blacks who came over and said that we want Americans to be able to be free from Britain. So there's this idea that Haiti's relationship just dates back so far. And there are some people, I should tell you, frankly, not the ambassador himself, but other people who have told me that they feel as though President Trump was hinting at ethnic cleansing. There's this idea that he sees Norwegians and he sees them essentially as white people who should come over, and that they are more valuable than Haitians, who, of course, are African-American, who are black.
That's Michelle Cinder. She is a Haitian journalist, and she makes some good points. While the entire world seemed to be focusing on this swear word, when I would say the vast majority of us use that swear word, we weren't really talking about the issue itself. And it's almost like that kind of thing is planned. So here's the way it goes. The book Fire and Fury comes out, and it makes the president look like what he is, a brain dead moron. And so he says, I'm going to find a way to get people to look at me differently, not as a brain dead moron. I'm going to have everybody watch me make deals and show everybody how smart I am. I'm going to get the Democrats and the Republicans in a room, and I'm going to make a deal. He decided to have this discussion with Democrats and Republicans at a table with the cameras. It was like a 2 or 3 hour feed. And what happened at that meeting, which was about immigration, he's going to hash out a deal, was he seemed to agree with every damn buddy at the table. Everybody. Democrat says something. That sounds good. Let's do that. Republican goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. What about doing this? He goes, ooh, that sounds good. Let's do that. So obviously, lots of masterful deal making, and it only exacerbated the problem. It only seemed to make things worse about what people thought of him. And then at one point he says, let's just, whatever you guys come up with, that's what I'm going to sign. Whatever you come up with. And he just kind of throws his hands up. And the whole room's just kind of, and they go, they do some more talking, blah, blah, blah. Nothing comes out of it. And it's embarrassing. And the media starts talking about it. Really? That was the famous deal making? That was the famous deal maker? Because that was awful. Please don't make any deals for me. So the media starts talking awful about him. And then he goes on television the next day and he goes, the media said it great. I did so freaking awesome. It's a parallel universe that this guy lives in. But the deal still isn't hashed out. But it doesn't matter, because the racists, the white supremacists, the Nazis that love this president, that support this president the strongest, they were clearly alarmed by what they saw in the room. And they weren't alarmed by the fact that brain dead moron was talking in brain dead moron language. What they were nervous about was that he seemed to agree with everybody at the table. And with agreeing with everybody at the table, eventually he might agree with a Democrat. And if he agrees with a Democrat, my God, we might not get these racist immigration policies that they want. Here is a sampling of the Breitbart's got a bunch of radio shows. So here's a sampling of callers calling it to Breitbart the next day.
First impressions of that meeting yesterday is flat out betrayal for the voters that put him in office.
I think of it as a swamp fest at the White House yesterday.
Whether he perceives that to be Michael Wolff, whether he perceives that to be Steve Bannon, whether he perceives that to be Schumer or McConnell or whoever, he's done it to himself if he messes up on this one.
The day he made those remarks, the media talked about it all day, and it went completely unanswered. And then The next day, he realized after making those remarks that they might not go over so well. See, inside sources in the White House tell us that what he was doing after he made those comments and they broke was that he was calling people and asking, how is this playing with my base? How is this playing with my base? You know, what do they think of it? That's really all he does anything in public for anymore. He's not trying to govern all of us. But he was gauging it. He was saying, how is this playing politically? And it turned out politically, it was not playing all that well. So what comes next? Well, obviously, the denials.
I can be more presidential than anybody.
Shocking comments from President Trump in the Oval Office.
I know words. I have the best words.
He attacked immigrants from Africa and Haiti using vulgar language to describe their countries.
The Haitian people deserve better.
Why do we want these people from, quote, all these shithole countries here?
I know words. I have the best words. I have the but there's no better word than stupid.
The meeting that happened with the president and a handful of Republican senators and a Democratic senator and some media figures, that what that was supposed to do was that was supposed to be where the new immigration deal came out of. So here's what happens. Dick Durbin, Lindsey Graham, they call up the president. They say, hey, you know what? Let's talk about this. Small room, just us. Let's see what we can come up with. President says, cool, I'm absolutely ready to do that. When Durbin and Lindsey Graham show up, there's already five hardliners sitting there next to the president, hardcore right-wingers. And the president's got a different demeanor about him. And so they approach the table, they talk for a while, things get heated, the swears start flying, and then Trump makes the comment. And Lindsey Graham later said the person that we talked to on the phone, even the person we talked with at the table, was not the same person that we were dealing with when we got inside that room. I think it's clear and clearer than ever. He does not know what he wants. And all he's really looking for right now is love and adoration and somebody to tell him that he's doing a good job and pat him on the back. And whatever it takes to make him feel good. And it seems like the only people that are making him feel that way are the hardcore racists, the white supremacists. So he's more eager than anyone to give them exactly what they want.
What he said was offensive, and it should be offensive to every American in the United States, because what he essentially did was take us back to a time in this country where we used to have an immigration law, and we interpreted the immigration law as prohibiting the immigration of people who were not white to the United States.
That's where it started,
and essentially he's taken us back there. There's nothing new here, by the way. His statements are offensive. They're not new, because he made similar statements about Muslims and banning Muslims as if all Muslims were terrorists. So it's really been part of a pattern of statements that he has made that assumes that if you are not white, you are somehow not worthy of being in the United States.
It was stated, why do we have to have these people come from these bleep hole countries? And by the way, this was going to be the one episode where I did deliver a swear because I heard so much of it in the media. But then I made a decision and I said, it's not going to really add to the show and it's not going to help me get my point across any better, even if I add swearing to this one episode. And I've got a 235 episode streak of not swearing on these shows, and I'm going to keep it that way. So he says, we don't want people come from these bleep hole countries. Why can't they come from Norway? Oh, God. What makes Norway so freaking great? Well, Norway is white. Very largely white. And they say, well, we should have maybe a merit-based system. Because there's this idea that we have in America. I'm reading one of Dick Gregory's books right now. And he says, it's interesting that so many white people think of African-Americans as lazy. When you stormed into our country and you stormed into our homes, you had no problem scooping us up, chaining us to ships, bringing us through the Middle Passage, bringing us here, and then turning us into slaves and murder victims and rape victims for hundreds of years. You had no problem making us do all your work. But the minute we're not doing all your work anymore, we're just a bunch of lazy Negroes. And so that's the idea. White people, not all white people, obviously, we're just talking Trump supporters here, see themselves as sort of the top of the totem pole. Well, they wouldn't like totem poles because that also has to do with brown people. But they sort of see themselves as the top of the heap, right? Genetically, because they're white. And that everyone else is below them. And that these they're so much better than these African Americans. But what's not discussed ever inside those circles is the education level. It's proven. And they will tell you this in the South. Mention the word academia in any conservative circle and just watch the heads collectively explode. There was an article I read recently on the show where Republicans were talking about how they don't want their kids going to college because they don't want them learning those liberal values. And there's an entire movement in conservative circles now to decry education as nothing more than liberal indoctrination. And so what is they? A lot of those folks, those Southerners, those white Southerners, those white racist Southerners that are pushing the idea that you don't need no fancy book learning. But these brown people come here from these African majority countries. They come here for a better life. And one of the first things they do is get an education.
You could say we want to go the way of Canada in a merit-based system. If you're going to go merit-based system, you have got more Ethiopian doctors in the city of Chicago than you do in the country of Ethiopia. People who are migrating here from many of those African American countries have higher degrees than Americans do. So please, if you are going to make these points, please make them rooted in fact.
Yep.
Well, that probably just that probably just pisses them off even more, because now, and they call them uppity. That word has come back, uppity. They say, well, now we got all these uppities telling us what we should do, how we should live. Well, I know how to live. I'm from the country.
Some quick facts, though, about what immigrants from countries described by the President of the United States as bleep holes do when they get here. More than 41% of African immigrants hold a bachelor's degree. That's compared to just 28% of the U.S. total population. Nearly two-thirds of Nigerian immigrants are college-educated. African immigrants are also very likely to hold advanced degrees, many of which are earned at U.S. universities. And Nigerian Americans have a median household income well above the American average.
And what a weekend for all of this stuff to come up. And of course, it was brought up on the weekend of MLK, and that just got the media going. And then, of course, they bring up all the other horribly racist things that the president says. And by the way, it's been 3 days by this point. 3 days! And the president still has not said anything. Some of his lackeys have come out and denied that he said it, but he himself hasn't said anything.
This, of course, is the same president who was accused several weeks ago of saying that we didn't want people from Haiti to come to the United States because they all had AIDS, also made derogatory comments about people coming, I believe it was from Nigeria, once they left their huts, they would never want to go back. This, of course, from what I saw yesterday, ignores the evidence that the immigrants that come to America from Nigeria actually have a higher education level than Americans.
Before making his horribly racist remarks, the president did declare MLK Day a national holiday. Heads up, it was already declared a national holiday. And then he decided that he was going to say a few words. This horrible, stark, raving racist decided that he's going to go ahead and, you know what? And this takes cojones. He's going to go ahead and play the role because it's that black guy's day.
Today we celebrate Dr. King for standing up for the self-evident truth Americans hold so dear that no matter what the color of our skin or the place of our birth, we are all created equal by God.
One of the things that helps perpetuate these myths that are largely created by white people, Some of them are socially true, but for the most part, they're largely created by white people and very racist white people. So there's an article by Charles Blow over at the New York Times back in June of 2015. And there's this myth about the absent black father. Part myth, and I'll allow me to explain. So, quoting from the article here, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, in 2013, nearly 72% of births to non-Hispanic black women, the mothers, were unmarried. It always seemed to me that embedded in the, quote, if only black men would marry the women that they have babies with rhetoric, was more insidious suggestion that there is something fundamentally intrinsic about black men that is flawed, that black fathers are pathologically prone to desertion of their offspring and therefore largely responsible for black community dysfunction. There's an astounding amount of mythology loaded into this stereotype, one that echoes a history of efforts to rob black masculinity of honor and fidelity. There are about 2.5 million black fathers living with their children and about 1.7 million living apart from them. So there are more living with them than apart from them. But there's still a big gap there. So how is it that 72% of black children are born to single mothers? How can that be true? Here are a few things to consider. First, there's a growing number of people who live together but don't marry. Those mothers are still single, even though the child's father may be in the home. And as the Washington Post reported last year, the share of unmarried couples who've opted to have shotgun cohabitations move in together after a pregnancy surpassed shotgun marriages for the first time in the last decade, according to a forthcoming paper from the National Center for Health Statistics, part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Second, some of these men have children by more than one woman, but they can only live in one home at a time. This phenomena means that a father can live with some but not all of his children. Levs calls these men serial impregnators, but I think there's something more than promiscuity and irresponsibility at play here. The New York Times extended this line of reporting, pointing out that nationally there are 1.5 million missing black men. Missing. As the paper put it, incarceration and early deaths are the overwhelming drivers of the gap. Of the 1.5 million missing black men from ages from 25 to 54, which demographers call the prime age years, higher imprisonment rates account for almost 600,000. Almost 1 in 12 black men in this age group are behind bars, compared with 1 in 60 non-black men in the age group, 1 in 200 black women, and 1 in 500 non-black women. For context, there are about 8 million African-American men in that age group overall. Mass incarceration has disproportionately ensnared young black men, sucking hundreds of thousands of marriage-age men out of the community. And the racism that gets constantly perpetrated by conservatives, by by Nazis, by white supremacists, by the president himself, it's this exact attitude and belief in a myth that has led to what we have with the African-American community. And then what conservatives tend to do is they go, look at black unemployment. It's not that great. Well, I guess you got to stop voting for the Democrats. Got to start voting for us. And they go, look at you. Y'all are locked up. Single mothers, all of you. Democrats ain't doing nothing for you. Trump said during the election to African-Americans, what the hell do you have to lose? His words, what the hell do they have to lose? Clearly, further freedoms.
You cannot speak the words of tolerance and peace and love and nonviolence and then put down a group of people, a nation of people, because of the color of their skin, of what part of the world they may come from.
So Matthew Rodriguez, Mike.com, decided to take that CDC report that helped destroy the myth of the absent black father, or at least explained why we do have absent black fathers, that we seem to disproportionately have absent black fathers. And The title of the article is "These Powerful Photos Will Challenge All of Your Notions About Black Fatherhood." So I'm going to give you kind of my top eight bullet points from this CDC report. To see the photos that go along with it, obviously this is radio. You want to peep it yourself, you can go over to themike.com. By Matthew Rodriguez, "These Powerful Photos Will Challenge All of Your Notions of Black Fatherhood." Just the bullet points, though. One, black dads are more involved with their kids on a daily basis than dads from other racial groups. This is all from the CDC report. Black fathers ate meals with their young children more than their white and Latino counterparts. Black fathers also escorted their 5 to 18-year-old children to activities more than fathers of other races. More black fathers live with their kids than live apart from them. Over 70% of black dads bathe, diaper, or dress their children every day. For those black fathers who did live separate from their children, they read to their kids, changed diapers, and helped with homework more often than any other dads. A higher percentage of black fathers, 40.6%, help with homework or check homework than white fathers. A higher percentage of black fathers, 34.9%, read to their kids daily, more than white fathers. I grew up in a largely African-American neighborhood, and even I, who was caught up by this same economic prison, this same social net, you know, that's meant to ensnare only African-Americans, it doesn't. It ensnares white people, too. And the dream for all of us, right, and a lot of my friends, you know, I had friends that damn near none of us lived with our fathers. I didn't even meet my father until I turned 15. I had friends that knew their fathers, but maybe they didn't live with their fathers. So, hey, they were, statistically, what I've just read would make sense. They were ahead of me there. But none of us lived with our fathers. And there's any number of reasons for that. And it's not, that part of it's not racial, except for the fact that we seem to lock up black men than we do white men. And this idea where Jeff Sessions wants to start going after marijuana again, this is an old idea that it's mostly black people that smoke the pot marijuana when it isn't. But for the police who are practicing racial justice, I suppose, for them, they would really, really, really like to have a reason to pull over more black men, to stop and frisk them on the street. Because African Americans do not use drugs at a higher rate or higher percentage than do whites. But they're the ones who seem to get caught up in these nets the most.
As recent unfortunate events have demonstrated, we cannot be complacent about racism and bigotry. And I would challenge all of you to pledge yourselves to building an America where incidents of racial hatred do not happen, because racism has been banned not just from the law books, but from the hearts of the people.
Contrary to that clip, Reagan was not great on race. Reagan launched his campaign as the official presidential nominee of the Republican Party by going down to Philadelphia, Mississippi. It's the first place he went. Philadelphia, and I tell the story all the time, and I will to the day I die, because Don Jr., as soon as Trump got the nomination, did the same thing. Went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi. What the hell is Philadelphia, Mississippi famous for? It's not a particularly large town, but it is the place where three civil rights workers were brutally murdered back during the civil rights fight. There was a movie made about it called Mississippi Burning. And Don Jr. and Ronald Reagan both went down there. The Republicans have been playing this racial game for a long time, and it's been a lot of dog whistle. So Ron Reagan, and of course, or Ronald Reagan, his son calls himself Ron Reagan, and he's a progressive, which is super strange. But so Donald Jr. and Ron Reagan did the same thing after getting the nomination, went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and gave a speech about states' rights. States' rights, right? And it sounds good, right? But it's dog whistle language. States' rights, welfare recipients. All of these things mean black. And the problem with Trump now for Republicans is he's not using the dog whistle language anymore. He's being outright racist. So there was a meeting, the headline over at NBC News, Trump thinks only black people are on welfare, but really, really, white people receive more benefits. Quoted from the article here, President Donald Trump was apparently unaware that not all, in fact, the vast majority of welfare beneficiaries are not black, as recently as last March, according to a new report. In spring of 2017, the newly elected president met with members of the Congressional Black Caucus. During the meeting, one of the members mentioned to Trump that welfare reform would be detrimental to her constituents, adding, not all of whom are black. The president was incredulous. What? Then what are they, he says. Statistically speaking, the congresswoman said, they're probably white. In fact, whites are the biggest beneficiaries when it comes to government safety programs like the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, commonly referred to as welfare. White people without a college degree, 18 to 64, are the largest class of adults lifted out of poverty by such programs, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The think tank's 2017 report stated that 6.2 million working-age whites were lifted above the poverty line in 2014 compared to 2.8 million blacks and 2.4 million Hispanics. He thought that this was a program because this is amazing. He watches Fox News, and that's where he gets all of his ideas from, and that's where he gets his talking points from. And Fox regularly promotes this idea with that same dog whistle language that welfare is just there supporting black people, and that if we simply cut welfare, it's going to hurt black. It's going to hurt white people more, but white people, the same racist white people who want this cut, don't realize that it's gonna hurt them too. With all of the discussion about that word, and that's the way it was turned, the swear, that word. The thing that struck me the most about that meeting with the president in the Oval Office, the thing that struck me more than anything else wasn't the S-hole comment, or even that he mentioned African countries. Yeah, we know the guy's a stark, raving racist. The thing that bothered me the most was what followed after that comment. He said these three words, very haunting. He said, take them out. We do not want these people. Why are we bringing all these people from these S-hole countries? And then he said, take them out.
He carved out Haiti, tweeting, quote, never said anything derogatory about Haitians other than Haiti is obviously a very poor and troubled country. Never said take them out, made up by Dems. I have a wonderful relationship with Haitians. Probably should record future meetings. Unfortunately, no trust. Yeah, you probably should, sir.
Someone at the meeting, and I don't remember who, and I suppose it's not that important, but someone at the meeting said, sir, we can't take them out. They have brown skin, and if you start taking them out, it will be pretty clear why. We didn't get any clarity on what take them out meant, whether that meant kill them or start kicking them out. I'm going to assume that it's the latter rather than the former. So back to the spending again. There's an article over at Raw Story. The headline says, voters who object to federal spending have a racist motive. This according to a study. Despite benefiting the most from taxes, people in many of the United States' poorest regions, which vote Republican, appear to oppose federal spending due to bigotry. A study published in the American Politics Research Journal and summarized in the Harvard Business Review reveals that conventional wisdom that places poor white Republicans in states that receive tax benefits against Democrats in states that pay higher taxes to benefit those in poverty is not supported by evidence, thus creating what researchers refer to as the federal spending paradox. This paradox led researchers to delve into three factors: party identification, ideology, and racial resentment. They define racial resentment as a post-civil rights era view rooted in the denial of continuing discrimination against African Americans, doubts about their work ethic, and resistance to government efforts to reduce racial inequalities. As one might have guessed from the racial undertones often present in public discussions on fiscal politics, greater racial resentment was associated with lower support for spending, despite the fact that white people get more of that money. Back to the article, the report noted, this remained true even when we accounted for other demographic and political characteristics such as gender, race, age, education, income, party affiliation, ideology, and so on. In fact, it continued, racial resentment was far more powerful in predicting opposition to federal spending than economic self-interest was. For example, it was four times stronger than outcome as an indicator. So you might be wondering, how were they handling all of this in conservative media? I've given you middle-of-the-road media. I've given you what the lefties like myself are saying. But how were they handling this in conservative land? So in the morning, I catch Brian Kilmeade's show. Now, they do this. Now, what Brian Kilmeade was doing, they tend to do throughout the entire day. I swear, though I've never seen it, they're working off the exact same list of talking points. They get into the president's comments a little bit, and they say, you know what? His language may not have been great, but he was kind of right. And here's why he's right, and here's why the Democrats are wrong, and here's why Democrats are going to hell. And then they walk away from it. It's a larger discussion about the racial implications and all the rest, you know, spending implications, budgetary, and but in conservative media, they go, this is a distraction. This isn't even the real problem. You know what the real problem is? Communism.
It's time to play that game that's fun for the whole family. Is it the Communist Manifesto or is it the Democratic Party platform?
We will push for a societal transformation.
Communist Manifesto.
We've established new classes, new conditions of oppressions, new forms of struggles that replace the old ones.
Communist.
No, I feel like all the answers are going to be Democratic.
What's your answer?
Okay, I'll go with Democratic.
Party platform?
Because the Democrats are clearly a bunch of communists. This is the day after. And that wasn't even it. It was an entire segment that he decided to sit down with this guy and do about, my God, the commies are coming for us.
All right, Ami Horowitz is back. Ami, what'd you do? Where'd you go?
So I went to outside of NYU, East Village of New York, hipster capital. And I, you know, there's so interesting. You talk about how demographic shift is happening that is moving away from the Republican Party. The reality is that the Democratic Party is the one who's really moving away from mainstream America, becoming more and more radical, more and more leftist. So I wanted to put that to the test and literally have a test, a game show on the air with people where I wed them a quote and they had to identify for money if that quote was from the Democratic Party platform or the Communist Manifesto.
This game that they were playing, is it this or is it this? Is it this or is it this? This is an old game. And you can bend this game any way you want to make it say anything you want. I saw one a while back made by progressives where it said, did Adolf Hitler say it or did Ann Coulter say it? And they simply replaced the word Jew with the word liberal. And they were able to make, so does that mean that Ann Coulter is Hitler? Clearly not. This is an old political game, but it works. And it really gets people going, oh my God, is that? And then of course, so right after Brian Kilmeade's show comes Rush Limbaugh's show. And yeah, the first thing he starts doing is freaking out about, oh my God, the commies are coming for you. So an old line with them too. It's the same line all the time. Yeah, I know that the GOP is doing a terrible job. Yeah, I know that the president's a stark raving racist, you know, and he endorsed a child molester and he's probably a racist. But that doesn't matter because communism. And then when Rush did decide to get into the immigration debate, He did it in the same, with the same style I've come to expect from old Rushmo.
Why does immigration, why do the Democrats insist on an immigration system that ends up being a burden to this country? That's not what it's supposed to be. And Trump looked at what they proposed and instinctively understood that this is rotten, that this is not anywhere near making America great again.
Slogan, slogan, slogan. The Democrats just want to bring more of their people here. You know, the Democrats just want to throw the doors open and just bring in all kinds of these ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Dang-gum Democrats, they just want some more Democratic voters.
Do the Democrats believe that only people in poverty, that only people from war-torn or tyrannical regimes, are they the only people that should be given preferential treatment to come to the United States? Is it because they're the oppressed? Remember, the Democrats want these people as voters. The Democrats need a permanent underclass. Donald Trump is looking at all of this, every bit of his agenda, as aimed at making America great again, not just a slogan with him.
So that becomes the talking point. You know, it's communism, and it's the Democrats just want to bring in people that are going to become their voters. And they're screaming that the Mexicans that come in and the blacks that come in, and we got to put a border on the southern wall. So the northern wall is a much longer border, and it's much more porous with even more challenging terrain to put a wall on. But most of our immigrants come in through there. But we're not going to put a wall on the northern border, because that's where all the white people come from. And we can't have all these people coming from these African majority nations, because we want people to come from Norway. More white people. And here's the other blind eye. I heard about a headline, this story, about how Russians are coming to America to have babies at Trump hotels. And it just sounds made up. So I decide to go peep the story for myself, and bloody hell, it's actually right. So the headline, Russians flock to Trump properties to give birth to U.S. citizens. So why Trump properties? Well, because there's a number of agencies that work with the Trump hotels. And you can find all of these at deliveryinusa.com. SVM Med, a Miami birth tourism company that also boasts outposts in Moscow and Kiev, offers three tiers of packages for its clients, with the top two advertising lodging in Trump Towers. The most expensive package costs $84,700 for Trump Tower 2 apartment with a gold tiled bathtub and a chauffeured Cadillac Escalade or Mercedes-Benz. Miami Boom advertises an apartment at Trump Royale with two bedrooms and 2.5 bathrooms. The website doesn't list the price, but the same apartment is listed on other real estate websites for $5,000 a month. A third company, albeit aimed largely at Ukrainian customers, promises that Miami's Sunny Isles suburbs has excellent condominium options, some of which, like Trump Towers, were created by American multi-billionaire Donald Trump himself. And it goes on and on and on and on. So here's the way it goes. These folks come here from Russia, and they stay for the latter part of the pregnancy, so the third trimester, and they rent an apartment in, say, you know, Florida, obviously. A lot of these birth tourism companies are working directly with the Trump hotels. They stay here for the latter part, and then the kids are born, and they have dual citizenship. They have citizenship back home. They have citizenship here in America. And then the Russians go back home to Russia. And then when the child is, I think it's either 20 or 21, they can come here and apply for the entire family to become American citizens and stay in America permanently. Now, wait a minute. Why are people from Norway okay? Why are we not worried about the Canadians coming from the north? And why are the Trump hotels in Florida working directly with the Russians, working with these American companies in birth tourism so they can come here and have the... Why are these immigrants that are coming here and taking our jobs, valuable resources, and getting on our... Why is this not a problem? It's because Russians are white. It's because Norwegians are largely white. Canadians are largely white. So when the Daily Beast reached out to Trump to ask about the fact that his hotels are working with these birth tourism companies, it came back no comment from the White House.
And you want to have some evidence of this? You know, Dick Turbin was in the meeting. Dick Turbin's back in Chicago. He was interviewed on TV today, and he was confirming that Trump said what he said. Trump denied using that exact language. There's some people who are saying that it wasn't holes, it was houses that Trump said. But regardless, it doesn't matter. Dick Turbin's out there. I was there. I heard it. I was appalled. I was outraged. I was this. I was that. This is the guy who was accusing members of the U.S. military of being like Pol Pot and Hitler.
And this is what the discussion devolved. Dick Turbin. The guy's name is Dick Durbin. It was Dick Durbin, and it was Lindsey Graham, and of course, a reporter for the Washington Post, and pretty much everybody in the room that heard the word get said. But how dare he? How dare he point out something that really happened? His name is now Dick Turbin. And one of the phrases that gets used and used a lot is chain migration. And I never really thought about it when I first heard it until I started hearing it more and more. And then the producer of this show, Kevin, pointed out to me, he goes, chain migration is a racist term. And all of a sudden, I began hearing chain migration in a whole new way.
Came to the issue of, quote, chain migration. I said to the president, do you realize how painful that term is to so many people? African Americans believe that they migrated to America in chains. And when you speak about chain migration, it hurts them personally. And he said, oh, that's a good line. And then when I talked to him about the impact this has on family unification in a nation that values families with the flag as the most important symbols of our future, they scoffed at this notion. It was a heartbreaking moment.
Oh, that's a good, I'm going to use that. That's a good, this was good news to the president. Oh my God, that's a racist term. I could totally use that racist term. Conservatives are likely never going to come around on this. Tribalism and the inability to admit when you're wrong or when somebody from your tribe has done wrong. But for the rest of us that are good, decent people, we really need to join together on this. And we really need to understand what the honest implications of this are. This from California AG Javier Becerra.
You can only tiptoe around these things so long before you have to come out and say what it is. Call a spade a spade. And Donald Trump has made racist remarks before. And this is about as much as I think people should tolerate. So it's time to respond. Otherwise, what we are at risk of is allowing the exception, which is Donald Trump, become the rule. And that's the last thing we should allow in a country where we've worked for over 200 years to elevate our democracy and the principles that the Statue of Liberty stands for.
Even Steve Schmidt, a good Republican, Steve Schmidt, who worked on the McCain campaign, who is a Republican strategist and who now works as a commentator, a source for MSNBC, he goes, this is it. He goes, this is my party, and this is gross, and this needs to stop happening, and these are the kind of relationships that we can forge going forward with making perhaps the rest of the country realize what's really happening here?
Well, I think the issue with the book is that people believe it's true because we've watched for the last year the chaos of this administration unfold in front of our own eyes. And again, he just seems to have absolutely no understanding at all about the First Amendment, about freedom of the press, the right of free expression. And it's just remarkable to see the president of the United States reacting to a book like this. Just incredible.
Decency and respect. They're not liberal values. They're not conservative values. They're absolutely American values. I was listening to a commentator do a roundtable. I think it was on Deadline White House. And the guy peeks up. He says, I'm a liberal. And as a liberal, I believe. And she goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not a liberal thing. This is an American thing. This is a decency thing.
you know.
But I think and the, that, and the well, other
he's got,
thing
he's got neuroses.
He doesn't accept this premise, which I believe in devoutly as a small L liberal, is that we're a country where we take in refugees. We give asylum to people. That has been part of our history. His own mother was an immigrant. The Statue of Liberty stands 5 miles from here.
Listen, I'm not going to let you do that. That's not a liberal value. That is an American value. George W. Bush was for comprehensive immigration reform.
Liberal, like 19th century British liberal.
I understand what you're saying, but let's not pretend that this is so abnormal. This is a freak show. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you disgraced the White House today by what you did to Hallie Jackson, but Donald Trump disgraced the country.
We'll play the Hallie Jackson clip another time because we're running low on time. But what she says there is the way that we should all feel. We should all have a collective outrage about this. And when it finally failed with everybody except for his base. Yeah, played well with the base. They loved it. Bunch of freaking racists. But when it failed across the board with really everybody else, after 4 days, he finally comes out and says, I'm not a racist.
No, I'm not a racist. I am the least racist person you have ever interviewed. That I can tell you.
No, you can't tell me that. If you find yourself saying the words, I am not a racist, then you have already lost. So there's an article over at Raw Story. And the headline is, Trump believes that a terrorist attack could save the GOP in 2018. Whether it's stoking fires in Jerusalem and in North Korea, and of course racial fires here at home, and of course doing embarrassing things on the world stage in China and Norway and India and all the rest. It almost seems like he's just trying his hardest to destroy not just the country, but the government, our reputation, our image, the way we're perceived to the rest of the world. And the president has been warned that a blue tsunami is potentially coming and going to sweep him out of there. You know, sweep. I mean, he might get impeached if the House and the Senate goes to Democrats. And of course, even if he stays in the House and Senate going to the Democrats, he's not going to be able to push any of his racist policies through. So quoting here, faced with the likelihood of a blue tsunami in the 2018 midterm elections, President Trump is holding out hope that terrorists will attack the country. This according to the Washington Post. In private conversations, Trump told advisors that he doesn't think that the 2018 election has to be as bad as others are predicting. He's referenced the 2002 midterms when George W. Bush and Republicans fared better after the September 11th terrorist attacks. This is a frightening line of thinking and one that it seems like the president is going with. Midterms are always bad for the party in power. They always lose at least a little, but likely a lot of seats in Congress. But in 2002, this is true. After the terrorist attack, the Republicans didn't do too bad in 2002 when they should have suffered. Of course, they suffered in 2006, and that's just the way these things go. You know, President Obama suffered in 2010 and 2014. In these off years, only the most motivated people tend to turn out. And when people are afraid, more people will turn out, but they tend to go for the folks that talk the toughest. And the folks that talk the toughest, it's not a real solution, but talking tough, they will keep the GOP in power. And the president is talking openly inside the White House with people that are there with him. He says, you know what? Terrorist attack wouldn't be that bad. Now, luckily, the president's not going to carry the thing out himself, but he could instruct certain agencies to stop doing this or stop doing that, knowing full well that it's likely going to lead to a terrorist attack. It's an amazing show for all of this to happen on MLK weekend. And on MLK day, the president decided not to do any service. Every other president's done some kind of service because that's what MLK would have wanted. Trump decided to go golfing. But I want to leave you with some words. First clip is going to be from Robert Kennedy. This is the speech that he delivered the night of MLK's assassination.
You can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love.
Race really is an illusion, And race really, racism is something that we do not have to give into. And I still believe the vast majority of people to be decent people. And I say that they will not give into it. They will not buy into this land of racism, and they will not allow this president to keep doing this same kind of damage. And none of us are, unless you're Native American, I am, but I'm only part. So part of me is from someplace else, Ireland, if I'm not mistaken, and some other places. But even my ancestors, they're not, I mean, most of them are not from here. Most of yours likely are not from here either. We're all immigrants here. But to go from this idea that America is chosen by God and that America is white and purity and all these other arsehole things that the president and the conservatives, the Republican Party, the GOP, the racist base, the KKK, the white nationalists, that they say. Let us not forget, when you show up to the harbor and you're greeted by the Statue of Liberty, there's a plate that sits. And I understand that I have to give civics and history to the president now. There's a plate that sits right under Lady Liberty. And let us not forget those words.
Mr. President, in case you missed it, these words are inscribed on a plaque, on a pedestal, on a statue it's called the Statue of Liberty. It's in New York Harbor, a place called New York City. And here's the poem. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out, our official home, tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry. You can email us at tficpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. We are not a racist country. America is an idea. It's not a race. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.